All right. Welcome to the Guiding Lights. This is the time that I share directly from the Bible, and I share as my mind reads. What happens when I read now, when I read almost anything, not just the Bible, is that my mind is automatically, simultaneously giving me a right-minded interpretation. And so I'm reading from the Bible, and I'm sharing with you the right-minded interpretation that my mind gives. And we're reading from the book of John. And the last time we were here was 2 weeks ago, because last week, Paltalk had major technical issues. So it just didn't happen. So this week, we're going to try again what we tried to do last week. But 2 weeks ago, when I was reading to you from the Bible, I was reading to you from John chapter 6. And Jesus was saying some things that sounded very strange to a lot of people. He said, "Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me, and I in him." And what we saw was nearly all of his disciples left him after this teaching. They're like, this is a hard teaching. You know, it sounded to them maybe like Jesus was teaching cannibalism. And according to the Bible, all of the disciples left except for the 12. And as I mentioned to you, there may have been some women that hung around that just aren't mentioned in the Bible. The Bible was probably focusing only on the men. But there were around 70 disciples that were regularly following Jesus. And after this particular teaching, there was only the 12, looking at the men only. So that shows that a significant number of people did not understand Jesus' teaching, and they left. And in fact, there's nothing in the Bible that really indicates that the disciples did understand the teaching. They just seemed to have that internal feeling to stay. They didn't really have understanding, I don't think, but they just, it was kind of like, well, where are we going to go? They just knew to stay. When I was sharing this teaching with you 2 weeks ago, I told you that the message that I received as I listened to the teaching or read the teaching is that when Jesus is asking us to eat his flesh and drink his blood, he's not speaking as a human body, as a man. He's speaking as the message. He's speaking as the teaching itself. And asking us to devour the teaching completely, to take it in fully, to let it into every cell of our body, right? To complete devouring of the teaching. And that, of course, is a beautiful interpretation of the teaching and a very important message for all of us. Because with the ego probably knows, the ego being the mind knows that at some point it can't take us off of the spiritual path. You know, you could say there's a point of no return. We cross an invisible line and we're on the spiritual path until it's done. And so the only chance that the ego has for survival is to keep us at least somewhat distracted so that we spend a long, long time, and by that I mean many, many, many lifetimes on the spiritual path, never fully committing. It can't get us to uncommit completely, but it has the power to keep us from fully committing, to keep us distracted, to keep us interested in other things too. And so even when people understand Jesus' message, not as a message of cannibalism, but as a message of fully devour the message, even then for some people, they have to shake their head and say, that's a hard teaching. I'm not ready for full commitment. There's other things that call to me too. And so even with the right-minded interpretation of the message, there may still be those that walk away and just say, I'm not ready for this. And that's where each of us needs to look within ourselves and see what it is that we truly want. Are we ready to fully commit to the message, to the teaching that comes not only through Jesus, but through many, many others as well? And before we begin looking at today's teaching from John chapter 7, I'm going to play a song that we can kind of listen to while we contemplate our desire to fully commit. This song is by Stephen Walters, and it's called Nothing Less Than Everything.
I was walking down a lonely road, looking for a place to rest. There was no escaping from this ache inside my chest. Then I got down on my knees and begged for mercy, and I raised up my hands. And I knew the answer, even as I asked the question of just how much this love demands. And it's everything, nothing less than everything. I will take these ashes and offer them up to you. Shiva, Shiva, Mahadeva, Mahadeva. Shiva, Shiva, Mahadeva, Mahadeva. I was walking down a lonely road, looking for a place to rest. There was no escaping from this ache inside my chest. Then I got down on my knees and begged for mercy. I raised up my hands, and I knew the answer, even as I asked the question, just how much this love demands. And it's everything, everything, nothing less than everything will do. When everything is burned, I will take these ashes and offer them up to you. Shiva, Shiva, Mahadeva, Mahadeva. Shiva, Shiva, Mahadeva.
Right. So with that, we will begin reading from the Bible at John chapter 7. And in my Bible, this first little story in John chapter 7 is called Jesus Goes to the Feast of Tabernacles. So let me read the story to you. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee, purposefully staying away from Judea, because the Jews were waiting to take his life. But when the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, "You ought to leave here and go to Judea, so that your disciples may see the miracles you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world." For even his own brothers did not believe in him. Therefore Jesus told them, "The right time for me has not yet come. For you, any time is right. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify that what it does is evil. You go to the feast. I am not yet going up to this feast, because for me the right time has not yet come." Having said this, he stayed in Galilee. However, after his brothers had left for the feast, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. Now, at the feast, the Jews were watching for him and asking, "Where is that man?" Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, "He is a good man." Others replied, "No, he deceives the people." But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the Jews. So this is a story that, as far as I remember, and again, my memory is not perfect, so I could be wrong, but as far as I remember, it doesn't show up in any of the other Gospels. And it's interesting because, read with the wrong mind, maybe you would think that Jesus is afraid. He's hiding, he's doing things in secret. He's not fully making himself public at this time. But read with the right mind, what you really hear when you listen to this story is that Jesus has no interest whatsoever in what anyone else thinks about what he should be doing. The only thing that Jesus has ears for is what we would call the Holy Spirit, or spiritual wisdom, or inner guidance. And in fact, it's an incredible symbol that his own brothers, as you know, the close relationship of family. And so here his own brothers are encouraging him to, you know, go to Jerusalem and make himself known. And he checks within and says, "No, it's not my time." Right? That's the only thing he cares about. It's not my time. And yet, it's interesting because he does go, but he goes in secret without anyone knowing. So what does that symbolize? That symbolizes Jesus' devotion to truth. You see, it was important to the religious Jews that they go to Jerusalem for certain events, the Feast of Tabernacles being one of them. And Jesus' devotion does not allow him to stay away from this event, not because the event itself is important, that would be superficial, but because of what it symbolizes. It symbolizes a deep dedication to God. And so what we're seeing again in this story, as it symbolizes, is that Jesus is not at all concerned about the world or what anyone thinks of him, not even his family. But he's deeply dedicated to guidance and deeply dedicated to God and deeply dedicated to the within. You could even argue that he was not at all interested in being a man. I can't tell you what he was interested in being, but I'll use a symbol. I'll say he was only interested in being ears and hands. Ears symbolizing the listening, the following of guidance, and hands symbolizing the following through on the guidance, doing as he is asked. Jesus was not interested in being a man. He was only interested in being ears and hands. And he knew that the way to be ears and hands was through the heart, through devotion, through love. That takes us into our next story, which is called Jesus Teaches at the Feast. Not until halfway through the feast did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The Jews were amazed and asked, "How did this man get such learning without having studied?" Jesus answered, "My teaching is not my own. It comes from him who sent me. If anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. He who speaks on his own does so to gain honor for himself. But he who works for the honor of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There is nothing false about him. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me? You are demon-possessed," the crowd answered. "Who is trying to kill you?" Jesus said to them, "I did one miracle, and you are all astonished. Yet because Moses gave you circumcision, though actually it did not come from Moses, but from the patriarchs, you circumcise a child on the Sabbath. Now if a child can be circumcised on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry with me for healing the whole man on the Sabbath? Stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment." Now, some of you may remember there was a story of a healing that we read earlier. Let's see if I can go back and find where it was. It was at the beginning of John chapter 5. It was called the healing at the pool. And this would have been the last time that Jesus was in Jerusalem. And there was a man, an invalid, who said he could not get into the well, right, because he was paralyzed. And Jesus asked him if he wanted to be healed, and then told him to get up, pick up your mat, and walk. And the Jewish leaders perceived this as a sin, because on the Sabbath, you aren't supposed to do any work. And they called this healing work. And so they perceived Jesus as a sinner. And so this is Jesus's next time in Jerusalem, although many, many months have passed now. He's now in Jerusalem again, and he's facing them again. And so he brings up this topic. He's bringing this back up. And he's pointing out that you circumcise a baby on the Sabbath. And the reason for that is, if I remember Moses' law correctly, the law is that the baby is to be circumcised on the eighth day after the birth. So sometimes that eighth day falls on the Sabbath, right? Now, of course, on the Sabbath, there's supposed to be no work, But now you have a conundrum. You have two laws that appear to be in conflict with each other if the eighth day falls on the Sabbath. Which law do you follow? Do you follow the no work law, or do you follow the circumcise on the eighth day law? And somewhere within themselves, you know, somewhere once upon a time, it was decided that it was okay to circumcise a baby on the eighth day, because maybe, because that was God's work. That was a part of God's law, and so that was acceptable. And so Jesus is saying, doesn't healing fall into that same category? But what he's really asking them to do, he's asking them to turn away from their head, from their learned laws, and shift into spiritual intuition. Jesus never says anywhere that he's against Moses' law. But he does appear to put spiritual intuition above the law. In other words, you could say, if there's no spiritual intuition on the matter, we will follow the law. But if there is spiritual intuition, it's higher than the law. Some people refer to Jesus as a rebel, but he wasn't really a rebel, not in the true meaning of the word rebel. A true rebel is someone who rebels against the law just because they don't like rules. Jesus wasn't that. Jesus followed the law, but perceived the spiritual intuition, the current moment guidance, to be higher. And this is what he's teaching. Again, remember we said earlier that Jesus doesn't desire to be a man. He desires to be ears and hands. It's a man that memorizes law and then either follows it or rebels against it. Right? Depending on the personality of the man. Or in this case, a woman. Whenever I use the word man, by the way, for me, man points to humankind. You know, that's another definition of the word man. It's just an overall umbrella word for humankind. So when I say man in this context, it includes females. So again, Jesus is asking them, in fact, the very last sentence, he says, let's see, where is this very last? Okay, he says, stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. He's asking them to tune in to spiritual intuition. Now, there's something very interesting about that comment, too. Jesus is recognizing that everyone has access to the same spiritual intuition. Jesus isn't telling them, I'm right and you're wrong. Jesus is asking them to tune into spiritual intuition. Because he knows that if we put aside our beliefs, whether we are law-abiding type personalities or whether we are rebel type personalities, if we put aside that personality and the way that personality normally thinks, and check within. We're all checking within with the same wisdom. So Jesus knows that if they check within and they check with their spiritual intuition, they can no longer hold a judgment against him for, quote, healing on the Sabbath, that it has to be let go. This is also why Jesus said what he said in the first part of this particular speech. Remember, in the first part of this particular speech, he said, my teaching is not my own. It comes from him who sent me. And then listen to this sentence. If anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. If anyone chooses to do God's will, He will find out. How will he find out? Because he'll hear the same teaching coming through him. The same wisdom. You know, once upon a time, like many people raised in our culture, I thought Jesus was special. And by special, I mean better than me. Maybe better than you two if I had been pushed to ask that question, but I didn't really look at it from that point of view. I thought he was better than me, right? More connection to God, more spiritual clarity, more, you know, special power, right? Better than me in all of those ways. And I'll tell you how I learned that was not true. I was actually in Israel. And I was on a hillside that is called the Mount of Beatitudes. And it's where tradition says that Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, which many of you are probably familiar with, at least somewhat. And so I'm there on that same hillside, you know, with a tour of people who traveled to Israel with me. And someone asked me to teach from the Beatitudes while we were there. And so I said, okay. And I think it was NTI I had with me. Might have been the Bible, but I think it was NTI. On some trips I taught from NTI, and other trips I taught from the Bible. But I think on this trip I was actually teaching from NTI. So I opened NTI to the Beatitudes, to Matthew, NTI Matthew chapter 5, and I began to teach. But the clarity that came through me was beyond my own. Just as those who appeared to be listening to me were hearing this clarity and learning from it or realizing from it, I was hearing this clarity and learning from it and realizing from it. I appeared to be the teacher. If you didn't know better, you might think I was teaching you what I already knew. But I knew that wasn't true. And that's when it dawned on me, this is exactly what happened to Jesus. He wasn't teaching people what he already knew. He was just opening his mouth in willingness. And it was coming. And this is why he says things like, my teaching is not my own. And he also says things like, if anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. And of course, if I can sit there on the Mount of Beatitudes, and I can teach beyond my own clarity, then I know where the teaching comes from. And anyone else who chooses to be empty, not learning first, planning their teaching and teaching what they know, but just showing up in willingness, choosing to be empty, they learn the same thing. Anyone, they learn the same thing. They learn that what comes through them, they did not previously intellectually know. And so they know it comes from beyond them. So just as at the end of this speech, Jesus is saying, stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. And in that statement, he is stating the knowledge that they have the same intuition as him. In the beginning of the speech, he's saying, anyone who is willing to do God's will is going to speak these same words, speak these same teachings, and then know that it wasn't ever me. It wasn't ever me, a man. It wasn't ever me, the guy from Nazareth, the son of Joseph. It wasn't ever that. It was always God. And anyone can learn that directly for him or herself. I'm going to move on to the next story, which starts at John chapter 7, verse 25. This story in my Bible is called, Is Jesus the Christ? At that point, some of the people of Jerusalem began to ask, Isn't this the man they're trying to kill? Here he is, speaking publicly, and they're not saying a word to him. Have the authorities really concluded that he is the Christ? But we know where this man is from. When the Christ comes, no one will know where he is from. Then Jesus, still teaching in the temple courts, cried out, Yes, you know me, and you know where I am from. I am not here on my own, but he who sent me is true. You do not know him, but I know him, because I am from him and he sent me. At this they tried to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him because his time had not yet come. Still many in the crowd put their faith in him. They said, When the Christ comes, will he do more miraculous signs than this man? The Pharisees heard the crowd whispering such things about him. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees sent temple guards to arrest him. Jesus said, I am with you for only a short time, and then I go to the one who sent me. You will look for me, but you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. The Jews said to one another, Where does this man intend to go that we cannot find him? Will he go where our people live, scattered among the Greeks, and teach the Greeks? What did he mean when he said, You will look for me, but you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? On the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the Scriptures have said, Streams of living water will flow from within him. By this he meant the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were later to receive. Up to that time, the Spirit had not been given, since Jesus had not been glorified. On hearing his words, some of the people said, Surely this man is the prophet. Others said, He is the Christ. Still others asked, How can the Christ come from Galilee? Does not the Scripture say that the Christ will come from David's family and from Bethlehem, the town where David lived? Thus the people were divided because of Jesus. Some wanted to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him. All right, so let's look at the interpretation of this particular story. First of all, when they're saying that we know where this man is from, and when the Christ comes, no one will know where he is from. The clarity that comes from that is exactly what Jesus turns around and speaks in the very next paragraph. But the clarity is, of course, they're confused, and that they think the Christ is going to be a man, a person, a body. And the Christ is synonymous with what some people may call the Spirit, and it's within all of us. It's the clarity of the awakened mind, which we all have direct access to. That is the Christ. And so we don't know where that comes from, right? We can look at this body, and we can say this body is from Nazareth. Or you can look at this body of Regina Dawn Akers, and if you know enough, you can say that body is from Coffeyville, Kansas. That's where it was born. But there's no body that is the Christ. And I'm sure everyone here knows that when you know that clarity, when you know that wisdom that is beyond your own thinking mind, beyond your own learning mind, how could you ever tell anyone where that came from? You can say that it came. You can say that you heard and you realized and you saw differently, but you can't say where it came from. So they're correct in their understanding that we can never say where that wisdom comes from. We can never say where the Christ comes from. They're just confused in that they're expecting the Christ to be a man, a person. And like they said, they do know where Jesus came from, right? And in fact, Jesus agrees with them. I mean, he understands that they're both right and confused. He says in the very next paragraph, yes, you know me and you know where I am from. Again, he's referring to the body. Yeah. Yeah, you know that I'm from Nazareth. Right? You're correct about that. And then he says, I am not here on my own. Again, he's pointing to that same spiritual intuition that he was pointing to just before when he was speaking to them, just a moment ago, when he spoke about anyone who wants to do God's will find out whether I'm speaking on my own or not. You know, he'll know if he does it himself, right? And when he said to them, you know, make a right judgment, right? He was pointing inward to their intuition. The same thing that's not a thing, right? The same thing that he's been talking about, he's talking about again. And of course, they don't get it. He's saying, I, and in this moment, the I is referring to the body that they're looking at. He'll say, I am not here on my own. There's not just the body here, right? There's something else here that is not the body. And that something else is the Christ. And you do not know where it comes from. I do not know where it comes from. It is just here. So he says, yes, you know me and you know where I am from. I am not here on my own. But he who sent me is true. Whatever this is that I'm speaking, whatever this is that when I stand here willingly and open my mouth that pours forth, I can't tell you where it comes from, but I can tell you it's true. I am not here on my own, but he who sent me is true. You do not know him, but I know him, because I am from him and he sent me. In other words, you've not yet had that experience of knowing this wisdom. I realize that. You've not, you know, you're believing what you learned. You're believing what you've always been taught. You think the truth is in the Torah, the truth is in the law, the truth is in behaving according to the law. This is your conditioning. And all you know is your conditioning. I realize, again, this is not a judgment. He's saying, I realize that you have not yet had this experience that I am having. And so you can't understand it. Heck, if I hadn't had the experience, I couldn't understand it either, right? It's not something you can understand until you live it. Nisargadatta said, in order to know something, you must be it. And Jesus is acknowledging that because they have not yet been it, been the experience of the empty vessel with God pouring through, they can't know it, right? So he recognizes that they can't know it yet. They don't know it yet. They don't have that direct experience. But he says, but I do know it. I do, and I know it's true. I don't know what grok is, Carrie. You may need to explain that to me. I'm sure it has meaning, or you wouldn't have typed it on the wall, but I don't know what that means. And at this point, again, it says they tried to seize him. There's a lot of confusion. You see some people in the crowd thinking maybe he's a prophet, maybe he's a Christ, other people thinking he's not. So lots of, they're all discussing this at kind of an intellectual level. From, I see Grok is from Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. I don't know that, but it sounds very interesting. Yeah, it sounds very interesting. Knowing with all of my being. Grok. Yeah. I knew it had some meaning. I knew you wouldn't just type a strange word on the board. Making up words, she is. Now, what Jesus says in verse 33 is kind of interesting, so let's look at this. He says, I am with you for only a short time, and then I go to the one who sent me. You will look for me, but you will not find me. And where I am, you cannot come. And they don't know what Jesus is talking about here. Jesus is recognizing that he is being public right now. Because, you know, he was, remember when his brothers asked him, you know, to come to Jerusalem and be public, he said, it's not my time. And then he was still drawn to the Feast of Tabernacles kind of in secret. And he was there for half the feast kind of in secret. And then all of a sudden, you know, this energy moved him to stand up and speak and to be public with what is, with his teaching. But he knows that he's going to go back into an introverted, private mode. He knows that he still, at this point, needs inner time with what I'll call the Father, what we call meditation or contemplation. He knows it's not his time yet to be fully public. And so he's telling them that. He's telling them that he's going to go, he's going to disappear, he's going to go within, he's going to be with the Father, and they're not going to be able to follow him there. And the reason they can't follow him there is simply because they're not ready. They're just not ready. And so he's merely telling them that he's going to go back within. He's going to take this inner journey. He says, you will look for me, but you will not find me. Because he knows that they, in different ways, are beginning to crave his public time. Some out of interest, more out of curiosity, and then again some out of a desire to prove him false, right? So he knows they have interest in him. He knows they have interest in him, but he also knows he still needs that alone time. And so he is saying, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He means now. He means right now while I'm here. Because I'm going back into the introverted mode. I'm going back into the alone time with God. But right now I have been guided to stand here in public. And if, as I'm speaking, if there's something in you, something that is confirming what I'm saying, and you want more, then come. Because right now I am here. If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scriptures have said, streams of living water will flow from within him. What he is saying again is, if you come to me, because when he says anyone who believes in me, he means you're getting that internal confirmation. If among this crowd of confused people, some wanting to attack me, some, you know, whispering among each other, who do you think he is, and all of that. But if there's someone here who's standing here in some kind of a stilled awe, right? Your mind has gone still and you're in awe, and something in you is prompting for truth. He's saying, come to me. and I will teach you how to access this inner wisdom. I will teach you how to access the same thing that I access when I disappear and go away alone. Right? I'll teach you how to access that. That's his promise. So if this is something you are interested in, come to me now. And what we don't know, at least from this particular story, is if any came to him at all. You know, remember he had lost all of his disciples except for the 12. Maybe here he picked up one or two more, right? Because maybe they heard something that sounded true and they went to him and they said, teach me, you know, teach me, Master. How do I access these living waters that flow from within? Teach me. But we don't know because it doesn't tell us. It just says that the majority of the crowd continued to have confusion about who he was, began to debate who he was, began to, you know, consider what they knew about the Christ and try and determine if he could or could not be this man. Yeah, again, missing the point, but that's okay. So that takes us to the last story in John chapter 7. This story is called Unbelief of the Jewish Leaders. Now there's a note here. I don't need to read the note yet, so we'll just wait. Unbelief of the Jewish Leaders. Finally, the temple guards went back to the chief priests and Pharisees, who asked them, "Why didn't you bring him in?" Listen to what the guards say. Are you ready? "No one ever spoke the way this man does," the guards declared. "You mean he has deceived you also?" the Pharisees retorted. "Has any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed in him?" "No, but this mob that knows nothing of the law, there is a curse on them." Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus earlier and who is one of their own, asked, "Does our law condemn anyone without first hearing him to find out what he is doing?" They replied, "Are you from Galilee too? Look into it, and you will find that a prophet does not come from Galilee." So what we do learn from this passage is there were people that got that internal confirmation. The guards that were sent to arrest him got that internal confirmation, and as a result, did not arrest him. Nicodemus, who is one of the Pharisees and the one who spoke to Jesus back in chapter 3 when Jesus explained that you must be born again, that was Nicodemus. Nicodemus also knows. I don't think Nicodemus could explain what he knew. I think somehow he knew that Jesus, the man, was not it, but yet it was shining through Jesus, the man. Yeah, and I don't think he quite understood what he was coming to see. But he knew that his brothers, the Pharisees, who were just judging strictly on the black and white of the law and not listening with their right mind, he knew that they were mistaken. And Nicodemus loved them also. Nicodemus took this opportunity when we had guards present who heard something true in Jesus to prompt his brothers, the Pharisees, to listen again. But they immediately dismissed his invitation and kind of began badgering him. "Oh, are you from Galilee too? Like, you know, why are you interested in this man?" Right? So we have a few people that are hearing something. And then, of course, we still have many who do not. Now, the comment that I told you I didn't need to read a moment ago, I do need to read now. So let me read this comment to you. It's about the next story. It says, "The earliest and most reliable manuscripts and other ancient witnesses do not have John 7:53-8:11. Which is the next story I'm going to read to you. It starts with John 7:53 and goes all the way through 8:11. And this is saying somewhere along the way, somebody added this. It wasn't here. It wasn't here before. So let's see what got added. Then each went to his home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you." Jesus declared, "Go now and leave your life of sin." So according to this, that story, which I think probably most of us have heard, is not in the earliest and most reliable manuscripts. One of the best stories in the Bible. So we don't know for sure if this story is true or if someone added it later. And that's worth pausing about, because the truth is, we don't know if any of the stories in the Bible are true. We had this discussion at the beginning of The Guiding Light. We talked about how if you really study Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John carefully, you're going to find that they aren't exactly the same, and sometimes they directly conflict each other. Right? So you know, if any one of us lives a life and doesn't write down our life and then dies, but having made some kind of an impression that people continue to talk about us for decades, and then after decades, people begin to write the stories down, at that point, at least some mistruth gets added, right? At least some mistruth gets added. This is true of both the stories of Buddha and the stories of Jesus. We have no way of knowing what's true about these stories. With Jesus, at best, it was decades before the stories were written down. And with Buddha, it was hundreds of years, we know, before they were written down. So what does that mean? Does that mean that these stories are useless to us? Or do you think the story I just read is useless to you, even though we know this story was added, was not in the earliest manuscripts? Sometimes it doesn't matter at all whether the story is, quote, true. What matters is what the inner intuition shares with you as you read the story. That's what matters. So again, we don't want to get caught up in the confusion of trying to determine what was the real life of a man named Jesus. In fact, if anything, what we've read today in John chapter 7, we have Jesus over and over again telling us the man of Jesus is meaningless. The man of Jesus is nothing. What matters is that, again, it doesn't have a name. This spirit, this clarity, this wisdom, and anyone, and everyone can access it. So to try and figure out what's true or not true in the story of Jesus is always missing the point. to get into discussions about whether Jesus was or wasn't married to Mary Magdalene is missing the point. To get into discussions about whether Jesus was or was not born of a virgin is missing the point. Even to get into discussions about whether Jesus did or did not exist on this planet is missing the point. All that matters is when we read the stories, what is the right mind telling us now? And again today, what the right mind has been telling us is that this wisdom, this clarity that appeared to come through a man named Jesus, assuming there ever was a man named Jesus, is right here, alive, right now. And it can come through any of us who are willing. All right, I'm going to read what Carrie has written here. To grok something is to understand something so well that it is fully absorbed into oneself. In Robert Heinlein's science fiction novel of 1961, Stranger in a Strange Land, the word is Martian and literally means to drink, but metaphorically means to take it all in, to understand fully or to be at one with. Today, grok sometimes is used to include acceptance as well as comprehension, to dig or appreciate as well as to know. As one character from Heinlein's novel says, grok means to understand so thoroughly that the observer becomes a part of the observed, to merge, blend, intermarry, lose identity in group experience. It means almost everything that we mean by religion, philosophy, and science. And it means as little to us, because we are from Earth, as color means to a blind man. Thank you, Carrie. So next week I'm going to begin at the beginning of chapter 8 again, which means we're going to look at this story that has been added about the adulteress. We'll look at that again next week. But again, what's important today that we wanted to see, in addition to the fact that we all have the direct access to the same inner wisdom that Jesus did, what's important to see is that it's totally irrelevant whether any of these stories are true or not. It looks like there's evidence that this next story was added at some point. And yet we're going to listen to that story, which may be completely made up, and we're going to listen to what the right mind has to say. And it will be as meaningful to us as any part that might be true. Whether it's true in form or not true in form is irrelevant. But what the Holy Spirit can teach through it is everything. All right, I'm going to be silent for a moment and then begin prayer circle.